This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Giovanni Donato. Giovanni, it's great having you back on the show.
All right, thanks for having me back once more.
So back in January, you published a novella, and it's not in book format, but you published it via a blog.
It was a dissident
fantasy fiction.
Yeah, it was a short story where I felt like inverting the roles of heaven and hell. Whereas in some of my past articles, I sort of regard heaven as things which are powerful and high status in society, and the hell is the realm of dissidents and people who would undermine the social order. So the antagonist of the story, or one of the antagonists, is a paladin of the light who's basically a feminist who's trying to hunt down the demonic forces. And through those archetypes and switching them out around a bit, I explore the conflict between them through a narrative.
And does it take place in a particular era or setting? Is it ancient times, the future, some mythical land?
That story is basically your standard sort of medieval setting. I wanted to choose something that was reasonably familiar to readers. In some ways, so the inverting the archetypes of light and dark would be a bit more jarring.
Oh, so you're saying it's an inversion, so the light is actually symbolizes the corrupt order, and dark is actually symbolizes the dissidents that are fighting for good.
Exactly. I sort of hinted that they all, as extremists, have their shortcomings, and anyone who takes that path pays a price. But largely, the darker are sort of like the rebels, the good guys who are fleeing the Empire.
And it's called Apostasy.
That's right, and you have to read the whole thing to figure out all the ways in which I mean it. First, you might think it's just the dark forces.
Oh, you're saying if you first read it, you might interpret the dark forces as the villains?
Or you might think that they are the apostates, but if you read the whole thing, you learn that I mean something else by it as well.
Your pseudonym that you use, Giovanni Donato, Giovanni the Damned in Italian, is...
Yep, John the Damned.
...named in honor of a condemned martyr.
A condemned heretic. That was like a two-sentence backstory I made up for my avatar.
Oh, so there was never... It's not a true story.
No. Yeah, no, I gave like a precise year or something to make it sound more convincing. But yeah, even my avatar story was fiction.
But
I thought the role... Even back then when I did that, I thought like the role of a heretic who's cast down by the priestly order or whatever, it seemed like an appropriate role.
And I also have a fiction novel out.
Journey to Vapor Island, correct?
That's correct. I think it's a lot more effective to get your ideas out there through fiction and art than it is through writing these lengthy academic, political, nonfiction essays.
I think we're both in agreement on that premise. I think it's sort of a alt-left or alt-center premise in general that arguments and policies alone won't change anything, but you have to offer a vision that will persuade people as well. Though, to be fair, I would say like more traditional wing neo-reactionaries would probably also agree with that.
There was an article in response to the interview that we did. It's called Alt-Centrist Scum Will Rise. Did you read that?
I actually posted it on my Twitter feed recently. I only found it by Googling alt-center just to see what would come up. And as it turns out, the idea that you and I have sort of been working on of an alt-center that isn't alt-right Bernie Bro, but it's not alt-right either. Something that takes the best aspects of each and works with the strengths of each. Apparently, some people have picked up on the idea and are talking about it. More than a few people, I think, are looking at the glaring shortcomings of the alt-right, which since the last time we've spoken has basically been in full collapse.
Yeah, it's been a complete implosion.
Yeah, I mean, there were lots of groups in action that we spoke about during the last talk we had. And at this point, Identity Europa is really the last major one left standing, and they have only survived by switching to the neo-reactionary pacifistic stance and are staying out of the direct limelight.
You do have all these bloggers and commentators that are loosely affiliated with this kind of alt-center sphere. A lot of them kind of had their origins in the alt-right or neo-reaction, then they went off and kind of did their own thing. But I would say most of these individuals are probably, in a sense, it's more of an offshoot of the alt-right, that because there might be some people who are former Bernie Sanders supporters, and I think the reason being is I think it could appeal to a lot of people on the left. But I think the reason why most of these individuals associate more socially with the alt-right is because of the barrier of political correctness.
Right. If you take a hipster or like a Bernie bro, and then you red-pill them, and you can get them to see the shortcomings of feminism and believe and understand how HBD works, you end up with someone like your friend Brandon Adamson, the former alt-left.
I think his blog is officially left of the alt-right, which I guess combined creates the alt-center.
Yeah. I would say that Brandon Adamson are sort of left of alt-right, but I would say are more of an expression of that center. For one thing, we all share a heavy concern with the aesthetic vision.
I mean, the blogger, Lion of the Blogosphere, is also, you would describe him as alt-center. He's maybe not interested in aesthetics to the same degree that we are, but he does talk about kind of us. He does have interest in kind of SWPL cultural things, and he talks about how conservative pro culture doesn't appeal to him.
Yeah, he's a New York Jew who believes in, who understands HBD and the shortcomings of feminism. He has a good model of how the world works, but he's not really an ideologue. He just sort of observes.
Yeah, he's a pragmatist, and I think that's a key factor of the alt-center. Alt-centrists are much more pragmatic about looking at what works and what does not. A lot of alt-writers and neo-reaction is they look at everything through an ideological framework.
And while Line of the Blogosphere is not, he doesn't seem to really be an artist himself, but he takes a keen interest in television and movies and even video games, and uses them as a medium for cultural commentary in a very alt-centrist way. I would say alt-right also comments on that kind of stuff, but usually they're looking at a very simplistic angle, like, for example, how quote-unquote paused it is.
Oh, yeah. I've done a lot of shows that are movie reviews, if you follow that.
Right, and I think an alt-centrist movie review, you're looking at the artwork as a whole, where in the more extreme dissident, or the more strident, I should say, dissident view, you're just lamenting how your enemies dominate the discourse while flapping your arms ineffectually.
Would you also make the case for some of the review writers, including Ron Unz, Steve Saylor, and Anatoly Karlin?
Yep, those guys all fit the model, I would say. People who at least try for a somewhat objective view of reality, and aren't ideologues as much as the actual leftists or an alt-right.
So one of your recent articles is titled There's No Power Without a Downward Distribution. This is a continuation of your theme on the topic of smart socialism.
Yes, I make the point in this article, since it's such a common theme of conservatives and right-wing commentators in general, that they want small government, that they don't want redistribution of any kind, that they just want people locked in perfect competition. But if you look back at history, that's not how any real society, especially any real successful society, has ever worked. You go back to ancient Mesopotamian cities, and even they had elaborate systems of redistribution from the city granary, which is something, if you've ever read Debt, the First 5,000 Years, David Graeber really elaborates on.
They, conservatives and libertarians, always look at things through the framework of the Old West, the frontier times, and this was a very unique era in history because it wasn't a continuous civilization. These were people who were moving out from the cities and towns in the eastern United States, and they were carving out settlements out of wilderness from scratch. And back then, it was a much more libertarian type society where there were no rules, and you had to kind of fend through them for yourself. But a lot of these libertarian and conservative types are so delusional to think that that would work in a modern urbanized setting.
If you think about it, just think how seldom it is in history that a group of people has a whole continent to expand into, and they can ignore their problems by sending the losers somewhere else, or your people who don't want to follow the rules, they can just go elsewhere. For 99% of the time, of any people or any species even, they are at some kind of equilibrium where they have to deal with the pressures that they're facing. They can't just sweep them under the rug. And in that way, American society is sort of out of touch with reality. It's barbaric because they've never had to deal with the question of what do you do with your mediocre people and your losers, and how do you keep them from revolting in the street.
And neither the left or the right has a solution, because the left says that basically they say that everyone is the same, and they advocate egalitarianism, and then the right talks about these people who are losers, and they just say, oh, they need to just fend for themselves and figure out a way to make money, and we can't take care of them. So both the left and the right fail to address that issue properly.
Right. It's like they take extreme opposite approaches based on the same immature impulse, and neither is interested in running a real society where it's all a question of how you redistribute resources in order to have an effective society that can outcompete your neighbors and make it so people at home are more or less content and not going to cause trouble at the very least.
So how would a functional society deal with, say, the lumpen proletariat in a basically a sane and civilized manner?
Well, you may recall we've spoken about new urbanism, for instance, where the cities are elite zones, kind of like Hong Kong would be in China today or Singapore, where you only are going to allow your productive elements access to those areas. Because for every lumpenproletariat you let into a zone like that, it's going to drive up. You're competing with more people to squeeze into that city, and you get a population of lumpenproletariats there. Productive people aren't going to want to be there.
Well, that's kind of happening already in a lot of major urban areas. What's happening is there's this massive gentrification going on, and the elites of those cities are encouraging their lumpenproletariats to leave by offering Section 8 housing in the exurbs. So that's basically going on right now.
Yeah, I'm well aware of gentrification, but I feel like it's brute forcing the problem in a very passive aggressive way. I mean, they're just throwing money at the problem until the lumpenproletariats can't live there anymore. Why not just make it a matter of policy instead? And so instead of using the crude method of driving up prices to only hipsters that make more than $80,000 a year are the only ones that can live there, just don't have lumpenproletariats there, and maybe even some lower middle class or middle class people can live there as well for a reasonable price.
Do you address the whole urban planning issue in this particular article?
Well, we're talking about redistribution in all its forms. So the allotment of extremely scarce land around a few cities where most of the economy is concentrated would be an important element of that.
So are you saying you're opposed to the lumpenproletariat living in major cities? Where would they ideally live?
Where, I guess outside the major cities. It wouldn't really matter where if they don't interfere with the main productivity of the economy. One wouldn't want them to be miserable to where they're going to revolt or riot. But the society as a whole would probably want a long-term eugenic trend, while not actually prohibiting anyone from having kids can de-incentivize it, just like they do now with the urban professionals who hardly have any children at all.
Oh, so you're saying that what's going on right now is they de-incentivize having children for well-educated urban professionals. You're saying ideally that would be the case for the lumpenproletariat.
Yeah, those roles should really be switched. Where presently the fertility of the lumpenproletariat is actually higher.
And how would you address those issues with actual public policies?
Well, we spoke about controlling access to the city to make space for more productive people, keep their prices down, and that way they don't have to commute as far or live as far away. Public transportation is a lot more palatable when you don't have lumpen proles that make this system unpleasant and dangerous to use. And you don't have minority populations running the trains and subway systems as a benefits job. Basic stuff like that is a good start, just to relieve some of that pressure.
And we've also talked about this before. I forget the word. It's was it population drain? How cities and have sort of become population drains for high IQ people.
Yeah, gene shredder. That was
gene shredder. That's right.
Yeah, I think I give Spandrel credit for that one. Yeah, he runs an NRX blog.
And then that's the problem, is you get these neo-reactionaries and traditionalists. They'll respond by just saying we should abandon the cities, and I think the solution is just to make the cities more livable, improve housing conditions, better schools, more park space, more recreation.
Right, whereas it seems like the right wing wants to be more focused around the countryside, which, as I've critiqued, that's a losing proposition, because the United States is a majority urbanized country, and that's where all the jobs and where all the young people are at. So managing those urban spaces is one of the most critical things that needs to be taken care of. And you may remember another element of the smart socialism was reverting to some form of state capitalism, where the government at least controls the commanding heights of the economy. A good example that I wrote about once was that the government ought to control natural monopolies on the internet, like, say, Amazon, and use them as utilities.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially with issues like free speech. So right now, social media can ban someone for having politically incorrect views, and same with YouTube, and I'm not sure if Amazon's doing it yet, but Amazon hypothetically could ban books that are politically incorrect. So ideally you would have some form of state capitalism where these corporations become public utilities, but there's protection for freedom of speech.
Yeah, where there is a natural monopoly, like capitalism is generally an ingenious way of price discovery when there is appropriate competition. You need the competition for that feedback, but if you look at other utilities, you only really want one water or electric company. You don't want 20 people trying to build water pipes into your house or building power plants and electrical wires. And if you look back in the 19th century, you did actually have private companies owning different lengths of railroad track, that none of which was joined together or used the same rail gauge. So naturally, you end up with governments intervening to make those things uniform and put that kind of chaos to rest, because competition is actually, when you have a natural monopoly, to the extent you can even have competition, because it favors a monopoly, it's just going to get in the way.
And that's
so if you only want one electrical company, I mean, you'll really only need one giant online retailer. You really only need one huge search engine. You don't want... I remember very well in the late 90s what it was like to have 20 different search engines. It sucked.
Yeah, it's really just... it's not a good way to access information. It's chaotic. I mean, people complain about monopolies, but I think having one search engine is fine as long as you have good regulations and protections for freedom of speech and privacy. I don't know if it's how feasible in today's day and age it is to protect privacy, but ideally I agree with you completely that these search engines should be public utilities.
And it seems like this is something that right-wingers often just refuse to understand, that capitalism only works when you can reasonably expect multiple people to compete over providing a service. And if you can't, if that's not the optimum solution for a situation, then a capitalism is not the ideal solution for that circumstance. Capitalism, I see, is like a tool, and you have to figure out where to use it and where not to.
And I would say the same with socialism. Utilizing socialism successfully in countries like Germany or Scandinavia or pretty much most of Western Europe, socialism's more popular because the middle class benefits a lot from things like free healthcare and free college tuition. There's not so much of a problem with massive student loans. Part of the thing about American conservatives is one side of the issue is American conservatives have this radical individualist streak, which goes back to this kind of nostalgia for the frontier times. But the other thing is a lot of conservatives, and even like a cuckservative who would claim to be totally not racist, or they look at the lumpen proletariat and they say these people are unproductive and they're moochers, so socialism is automatically bad and we need to cut all government benefits and programs, so they just have that reaction.
Yeah, I feel like they're just trapped in a knee-jerk reaction to leftist policies they dislike and are completely unwilling to evaluate good uses of socialism. Again, it's another policy tool like market capitalism is. Sure, if you misuse it, it's terrible. The whole point of redistribution in a society is to get resources and basically get blood flow to an organ that will help the body most. And I feel like they just lack that concept.
And it's not so much about the private sector or the public sector. You have to think in back to what I said about being a pragmatist about what works and what doesn't, and it's about utilizing that capital efficiently.
Yeah, again, it bears repeating that. I guess part of alt-centrism is kind of not being a frothing at the mouth ideologue and trying to keep a level head, using all the great things we learn from human biodiversity, from the manosphere, and taking all the wisdom that these people have come up with and try to formulate a productive prescription for action.
And another point you make is that human beings are social and tribal. Conservatives tend to think either in the sense, well, libertarians think in the sense of radical individualism, and mainline conservatives think in the sense of the nuclear family, but that doesn't take into account the fact that humans do have a tribal nature.
Right. I think they all have this blind spot because they all subscribe to the principles of the Enlightenment, where people are to be regarded as rational individuals, where in reality every person is a family, has a group, has a tribe, and even our economics are sort of observing the actions of these rational economic men interacting with each other. But what is more powerful is looking at how groups interact. And in fact, this is what actual industries like advertising already do. They have to be successful.
Yeah, that's how the advertising industry works. And if you watch a commercial, the actual commercials and advertisements have a lot of stuff that the right wing would describe as paused. And I don't even need to get into that. But when it comes to the kind of internal mechanisms, in some ways the advertising industry is politically incorrect because they have to talk about, like, say, this subset of this specific ethnic demographic, like, what do they like? What are their interests? What are their characteristics? So in a sense, if you want to succeed in advertising, you do have to have some basic knowledge of HBD.
Yep, and I guess they get away with calling it demographics, you know, enough syllables that people aren't going to look at it too closely. But instead of just running commercials, that same type of knowledge needs to actually be directed towards real policy and cultural formation in a targeted and measured way.
And you talk about conservatives and liberals. The reason that liberals are more successful politically is that their political demographic is much larger. You point out that they have white liberal men, a large, at least basically the majority of women, most ethnic minority groups. Basically, the conservative coalition is, well, first of all, conservatives are more individualist, so they don't think as much in demographic terms. But with conservatives, you say it's basically the lower middle class whites, and basically like geriatric country club Republicans.
Yeah, there are people that tend to be in the outer orbit of the cities or in the countryside. They basically have what they already want from life, so they're not going to tend to be very radical. They're kind of inert.
And
people that can't reach what they've got, it seems like there's something wrong with them, I guess. Because they've gotten as far as they have. But to be in perfect fairness, I mean, if you're just an average person in America, I mean, who's going to be more appealing? Someone who's talking about all the losers and pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps and all that tough talk? Or people that talk about inclusiveness and egalitarian, people being equal and taking care of people? I mean, the left vision sounds a lot more appealing at first.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's very feasible to win over a lot of these demographics that are on the left. And I think a lot of people in the alt-center and even the alt-right as well have talked about appealing to these demographics that are on the left. And I guess for starters is there's the basically the working class, and Trump was very successful in winning over working class white voters with his populist message, and I think a lot of those people, including not just the people who voted for Trump, but even a lot of the white working class Democratic voters, those people can be won over by a more economically populist message. But the problem with Trump is his message was populist, but most of his policies have been pretty much standard conservatism, and a lot of those people who voted for him in the Rust Belt, a lot of them will have second thoughts the next election.
Yeah, they will be disappointed. I don't think people will turn on Trump so much since what's the alternative from the other side going to be? Like, I was saying how the left is going to sound more appealing to a normal, empathetic person, but they are sort of painting themselves into a corner by embracing this coalition of the fringes, which is why Bernie bros are starting to cross over into the dissident right.
With the Bernie bros crossing over into the dissident right, I've heard of that phenomenon. Have you witnessed it firsthand?
I would say many of the alt-center are an example, and I've been a dissident for many years now, but I was certainly raised with all the typical liberal beliefs, and I rejected them as I grew up and learned more about the world.
So you have the working class voters and the people that Trump appealed to in the Rust Belt, and
by going for Bernie to begin with, they're already sort of, the progressive element has sort of split off from the establishment Democrat Party that allies itself with that coalition of the fringes. So there's already a dramatic split within their coalition that threatens to undermine them. Now, that said, the danger for Trump is not that people will turn against him, but that enthusiasm for him will be dampened, and he won't get the turnout that he needs. I mean, because he's the first right-wing population to have anything like to offer something positive in, what, 20 or 30 years? I mean, look at the guy who ran before him. I mean, you're talking about how only the 48% pay taxes and how the rest are sort of implying that the rest are ne'er-do-wells or whatever. And
yeah, Mitt Romney basically said half the country are moochers. But that's just how society is. It's not inherently a bad thing. If you study HBD, you just kind of have to accept that's part of human nature. There's going to be a segment in society that is hyper-productive, and maybe some people who are not, and you have have a functional economic system that deals with these issues, but you don't want to go the whole kind of right-wing social Darwinist route, which says these people are moochers, they're worthless, they can all basically starve. That's basically what Mitt Romney had to say.
So just picture the catastrophic tone deafness of saying something like that when you are running in a popular election for office. You know, that's just the conservative mindset, the old right mindset personified. That by refusing to lift people up and make alliances with the larger population, they doom themselves to political failure until that downward spiral becomes their identity.
And as far as building a broader political coalition, I think you also need to appeal to the more kind of swipple types with things like environmentalism, new urbanism, being pro-science, dropping a lot of the radical social conservatism. Not so much, I think, obviously the liberal elites were not going to win over, but I'm talking about sort of a lot of these middle-class swipple college students who voted for Bernie Sanders, and people who are into environmentalism and new urbanism.
Yeah, when you build a coalition, of course, you can paint yourself into a corner by having too many disparate elements that hate each other to the point where you're herding cats and you can't change your policy in ways that will and policy offerings in ways that will help you win, because there's too many people tugging in too many different directions. But you can be smart about building a coalition that'll work.
And as a way of winning over support, the conservatives always like to rant that the left wins by giving out handouts, but I think a successful alt-center should sort of copy that strategy of the left.
Exactly.
I mean, come out in favor of a basic income, just implement it in a much more efficient manner than, say, the existing welfare state.
If you aren't giving your supporters something, why should they back you in return? This immature frontier society, they're just unclear on how the social contract is supposed to work. You give and you take.
And even with the lumpen proletariat, the people who live in the inner cities, I think there has to be some level of compromise. So say those people, for instance, on one hand, they should get access to free health care, but on the other hand, we have to end a lot of these disastrous programs like school busing. So there needs to be some basic compromise so those people are taken care of, but at the same time, we can't allow them to cause harm to society.
Right. Yeah, I think even now it's telling that even our warped system has things like food stamps and homeless shelters and soup kitchens, because one of the most obvious things you can do to improve a society is make sure nobody is desperate for food, because then you get some real problems. Like people that are desperate and will do anything.
Yeah, basically they turn to crime, and a lot of people who have criminal records, they're totally unemployable. They can't get a job, so basically they become burglars, and in some cases some states even have welfare restrictions on people with criminal records. But the problem with that is it's just about punishing the individual, but it's not practical, because those people will just turn back to a life of crime as a way to survive.
Yeah, and it just makes society miserable for everybody else when they're always worried about what these desperate people might do to them.
In your article, I think you also address the whole sort of NEET phenomenon. And I remember in a previous article you talked about the differences between NEETs and the lumpen proletariat.
Where NEETs may have low income, like a lumpen pro, or they may work part-time or spend periods unemployed like a lumpen pro does, but on paper they might seem similar in some ways, but they're very different people. Like, NEETs often have intellectual interests and hobbies. They are heavy participants in what I've previously called the leisure economy. Whereas rather than a realm of paid work governed by the market economy, I mean, look at Wikipedia, look at IMDb, or TV Tropes, or any kind of open source software, or fan mods for games. Nobody gets paid for any of that. And you can see, especially with the internet and computers, the tremendous productivity people have when they're not getting paid and they do it willingly. And you look in the past at fame, at the people who wrote the best books, made the best music. They typically, in the past, they had a rich patron or someone like that that basically gave them some money to live and told them to swing for the fences and do what they make a great work without having to worry about basic security.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's generally a position that leftists support, but I support subsidizing artists and writers. I mean, ideally if they're talented, of course, but I don't know how you regulate that to find out who's the most talented. I think the most simple way would be not so much to look at everyone on an individual basis and say, who's the most talented writer? I think if you just have a basic income, it would just free up a lot of those people to have, because we're in, as you said in many of your articles, we're in a post-scarcity economy, so we need to kind of get over the whole like Protestant work ethic, and it's okay to have a kind of leisure class that dedicates their time to intellectual and creative pursuits.
Or at least even a working person might have more leisure. Like, what do Europeans have, like a month vacation, and they're still just as productive?
Yeah. So I was recently in Germany, and just from my observations, even with the whole migrant situation over there, Germany is far more civilized and advanced than the United States, and they have month-long vacations, they have a generous social safety net.
Yeah, and they still get more, as much if not more, done, because why not give people a week or months, a month or months off, so people can really rest up from the grind, so that they can put their effort into something else for a while. Since there is a leisure economy that benefits society in ways that the market economy doesn't.
And not for just...
The market economy has a very immediate focus. Like, to sell stuff on the market economy, you have to provide something that most people want right now.
And not just with the arts and intellectual pursuits, but even from an economic perspective, if you give someone a leisure economy, you'll also free up a scientist, and that will lead to more innovation.
Right. Because look at how in academia they have to spend most of their time fundraising, to where your high-level academics are salesmen as much as they are scientists. Having that basic leisure and security is what frees people up to do things that are more ambitious and more long-term. The market is very no-nonsense and practical. It's what's here and what needs to be serviced and done right now. I guess you can be an entrepreneur, but to be a successful entrepreneur, you got to be correctly read what it is people on the, what the market will reward.
And also, it's important to have a kind of a more specialized economy where every group has their own specific economic niche. There's this kind of concept in America, and I'm sure other countries to a degree as well, that everyone has to be good at everything.
Which is not really how effective societies work. Any mass society is supposed to have certain specialization. But I think America in general has a mentality where anyone can rise and anyone can fall if they fall behind the pack. And in the Protestant work ethic religion, the neets who are downwardly mobile get what they deserve. And it's a divine punishment for their falling behind in the race, whether it's from their lack of ability or refusing to participate with enough vigor.
So you talked about the neet phenomenon, and you also talked about incels. I don't necessarily agree with this. This is not my opinion, but I've read on a lot of alt-right blogs and Manosphere blogs that they say basically that the incel phenomenon is a good thing because those men shouldn't be reproducing and has a eugenic effect. So they're basically taking a kind of radical social Darwinist perspective I don't agree with that, but that's just a common opinion on the right wing.
That's basically the conservative mindset towards the market applied to the sexual market. But they love to talk about the best individuals with the most prowess, but I've pointed out that the way social animals work is by forming alliances, and people who are weaker may defeat the strong. And that if you want to have a serious society, you don't just throw people in the trash en masse if you can help it.
And I noticed with this whole incel phenomenon, it used to be just kind of like the butt of jokes in sitcoms, but now you're in response to that whole incident in Toronto where that man ran over a bunch of people with his cars, you're reading news articles comparing the whole incel movement to like a terrorist organization like ISIS.
I find that the latest focus on the breaking of incelitude into the mainstream is great. It's something that the manosphere and that the dissident sphere has been discussing for years. And it shows that despite the small number of people involved in that community, how influential we actually are and how the analysis we make of society checks out, and how the prescriptions we're making are miles ahead of what other people are saying. I feel like incel becoming part of pop culture is a huge vindication.
Well,
the dissidents have been saying this is a problem since at least 2010, and probably earlier.
Yeah, it's been a major issue discussed on the dissident sphere going back to a lot of those early alt-right and manosphere blogs. But I've noticed that even in the alt-right, there's this whole sort of meme like Chad nationalism versus like the incel leftist and stuff like that.
I don't take that any of that at face value, because I figure someone involved in the dissident sphere is more likely to be nerdy than they are to be a Chad, but maybe
yeah,
they're
sure.
Not quite. Maybe they're not quite self-aware. Like the Chad doesn't spend time on dissident blogs; he just doesn't.
Well, Chads tend to be more. They're not apolitical. I would say that nerds are overrepresented on both the alt-right, but nerds are also overrepresented among leftist intellectuals as well, even SJWs.
I would think they're more, it's just a product of being more intellectually active and more tuned into the world of ideas beyond just tangible things. Whereas yeah. Your archetypal Chad is mostly worried about material things like women and cars and money.
Do you think Chads can be beneficial to society, or do you see them as having more of a parasitic or drain effect on society, or do you think they can be productive?
I think they can be productive. They're great salesmen. The type of people you might want to be, like firemen or soldiers. They're people of action. They're leaders. But if you're looking at the realm of experimental ideas and societal analysis, it's not really their bag.
So your overall point is that for a successful functional civilization is you need a wide variety of characteristics. You need some people who can be intellectuals, you need scientists, artists, you need people who can be soldiers and police officers, you need people who can be businessmen, you need a wide variety of personality traits.
Right. I appreciate the self-improvement angle of the dissident sphere. Like, it encourages people to be the best they can, to stay in shape, to learn to do things with their hands. I'm actually learning a trade right now as part of the recommendations of the dissident sphere, and it's actually good advice. It's a tough road, but it teaches someone more intellectual to balance themselves by getting more into that physical realm. But that doesn't mean you've become someone who's naturally like that.
Yeah, because with self-improvement, I'm all in favor of self-improvement, but some of those game bloggers are like, everyone can become a Chad. I mean, that's nonsense. You basically, self-improvement is just about being the best that you can be as an individual.
Yeah, or taking stock pragmatically of your strengths, weaknesses, and capability, and leveraging those in the best way possible. Like if someone is book smart, maybe learning to shoot guns or learn a trade is great advice, because it gets them in tune with their bodies in another aspect of life that will help them with everything else they do.
We are getting close to the end of the show. I think to kind of summarize the show, what goals and objectives would you like to see with the Alt Center?
I think maybe now that the alt-right has sort of fallen from prominence, there's maybe sort of an opening there for the NRX, the alt-center, to sort of seize the center stage, so to speak, of the dissident sphere, and be measured, respectable people who can steer the discourse in a way that's not just a dead end of strident people screaming forever, and be able to reach out to people with different views and have a more measured approach to policy, and to get beyond the Enlightenment assumptions that have fettered the everyone from libertarians to liberals to conservatives by all of them working from those same flawed assumptions.
Yeah, because basically all the major political ideologies have failed us. Mainstream liberalism or leftism, mainstream conservatism, libertarianism, the alt-right never really got a chance to get to gain traction or gain power, but basically the
they
alt-right
had traction,
has...
All right.
They had traction, but now basically the alt-right is falling apart. So,
yeah, they entered into the pop culture, and guys like Enoch or Spencer were even known by regular people on the street.
Yeah, absolutely, but I'm talking about implementing public policy. So with a lot of these alt-center ideas, some of them are ideas that have been borrowed from the past and ideas that have been neglected. But a lot of these are brand new ideas that are very refreshing, and I think a lot of people out there are craving stuff that is new and exciting, and they're sick and tired of all the same old stuff.
Right. I think times have gotten better. There's a huge yawning vacuum, especially now, I think, that in the establishment and among the dissidents, different groups have been stepping up and all are found wanting or have failed. And people are starting to look for more alternatives. The last time we spoke about alt-center, the last couple times we spoke about that kind of thing, the alt-right was still very popular. And now that that's dying down, people are looking for the next thing.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. And it'll be interesting to see what will become of this in the future. Giovanni Donato, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
All right. Good to talk to you again, Robert.